Hello, this is Byron Richards, and you are tuned in to my weekly wellness update podcast, bringing you the health news that you can use, as always. All right. Well, let's get started with this rather interesting article that fiber, fish oil, and exercise, combined with weight loss, can boost adiponectin. Now, many of you may not have heard of adiponectin, but it's like leptin. It is a hormone that comes out of fat. And when your leptin and your adiponectin are happily working towards health, they rise and fall in tandem with each other, and they get along quite nicely. Adiponectin, very interestingly, is quite a powerful hormone. It enables insulin sensitivity at your liver, and liver-related insulin resistance is really the nail in the coffin, if you will, as far as what causes type 2 diabetes. So whenever you can elevate adiponectin, you are indeed reversing the problem or headed in the other direction, moving back towards more optimal blood sugar regulation. Additionally, adiponectin, well, it actually does a lot of things, but one of the other primary things it does is it acts as an anti-inflammatory, a primary anti-inflammatory in your circulatory system. So just as your adrenal glands make cortisol, it's kind of like oil in the car engine, I like to say. That's a hormone that's anti-inflammatory from the perspective of going faster and doing things. The faster you go, the more cortisol you make. Adiponectin is an ongoing circulatory anti-inflammatory. When you have enough of it, you make more friendly nitric oxide, which relaxes your vascular system. But most cardiovascular disease is progressive inflammation, and adiponectin's guarding against that directly. So it's actually a big story. So here we see in this particular study, they were looking into a review of the influences of diet on adiponectin. And this was a kind of a meta-analysis of published studies. But they found that the daily intake of fish or omega-3 supplementation, so this isn't just fish intake, but also the use of the DHA, EPA supplements, increased adiponectin levels, depending on the study, anywhere from 14 to 60%. Weight loss plus exercise increased adiponectin anywhere from 18 to 48%. And a 60 to 115% increase in adiponectin was obtained with fiber supplementation. I mean, that is absolutely unbelievable. Fiber supplementation, boosting it 60 to 115%. So these are basics, dietary basics that you really want to keep in place, as well as a lifestyle basic, the exercise, and achieving that weight loss trend. When you start to gain weight, your leptin levels rise in your blood and your adiponectin levels go low. So when they're healthy, they kind of parallel each other's functionality. And when you start to get into leptin resistance and sluggishness, tiredness, weight gain, cravings, the wrong pattern, that tends to suppress your adiponectin levels. And so just correcting leptin problems has a benefit to adiponectin. But here, fish oil, fiber, exercise, simple basics. There's lots of other nutrients that help this. But you don't want to forget your basics in terms of working this. This is very, very important to health, elevating adiponectin levels. Beta-carotene, lutein, and lycopene help maintain lung function. Well, I am harping on the past month here because we were doing our basic supplements. And to me, basic supplements include beta-carotene, lutein, lycopene, the carotenoids, as they're called. These are very important parts. Lutein comes mainly from spinach, lycopene from tomatoes, beta-carotene, and alpha-carotene from greens. But these particles are what the carotenoid structure, they're kind of like polyphenols, but a little different structure. But these carotenoids, they accumulate in your body tissue, and when they accumulate there, they offer protection to body structure. So wherever they're accumulating, whether it's your eyes, as we talked about last week, or other areas. They accumulate heavily in the ovaries and the testes, so they're very protective to the reproductive system. This is a study showing over a 15-year period, starting with young adults who were healthy, and those who maintained the highest blood levels had better lung function after a 15-year period. This is critical to health. I mean, you know, your lungs, your respiratory system has such a big impact on, well, first of all, you don't want to get respiratory bugs, and these things help you have a better immune function, but they also just help your respiratory system. Remember, we live in a very polluted environment. Anybody living in a city is exposed to all kinds of airborne particles that are pollutants to the respiratory system. It takes its toll. These carotenoids protect you, so you want to make sure you get these in your diet and in your supplements. You get all the whole spectrum, beta-carotene, lutein, lycopene. You want them all. They're very good for you. Was Giuliani Ranix, Rancix breast cancer caused by in vitro fertilization? I must admit, I actually don't know who she is, but I mean, I understand who she is, but I've never seen her speak or talk or watched her shows. But I was told by a reliable source that this was a celebrity, and the story interested me because the doctor's saying this lady's had three IVFs and then she gets breast cancer. She's a young person. She's 37. I think she's a vegan. I'm not sure. But whatever, she's not overweight. She's probably stressed. I don't know that much about her. But why I was writing about this is because the doctors were saying, oh, no. It's not possible. There's just no data to support that IVF can cause breast cancer. And I, of course, knew that wasn't true. I mean, first of all, just the common sense of it. Anytime you're stimulating the ovaries to make more estrogen, so as to enhance the operation of the cycling system to potentially get pregnant, you're going to be exposing someone to higher levels of estrogen stimulation. You do this once, you do this twice, you do this three times. It's a little bit of Russian roulette with how much estrogenic stimulation can your body handle before there could potentially be a problem. So I just, you know, to see if this doctor or these doctors were telling the truth about there being no association, did a literature search on this, and sure enough, I found two specific studies done in 2008 that showed conclusively that there was a 24% increased risk of breast cancer from IVF if you were over 30, and 40% increase for women over age 40, so she's at 37, so she's right in the middle there. And then, of course, the number of times so that you do it, the risk goes up. So there's very clearly associations. I just think this is yet one more example of women not being told the truth when there's a problem because they don't want to raise concerns and questions and so on. Yet the data is there. These are studies that have never been refuted. They are the most current studies on the subject. There hasn't been a study out after this proving there wasn't a problem. And it's specifically a problem in women as they get older because they've already been exposed to more cycles of estrogen in the course of their lifetime. It's that simple. I mean, the reason that women, young girls who start their menstrual cycle before age 12, their risk for breast cancer goes up 40% over the course of their lifetime because they're going to be exposed to more cycles of estrogenic stimulation. The estradiol, which is responsible for running the menstrual cycle, is a highly proliferative estrogen. It has to be kept contained like a fire in a fireplace. And if it jumps out, then the hormones start working against you instead of aiding survival of the species. And so these medical treatments where they're excessively stimulating estrogenic surges, they're wild cards. And, of course, now, you know, she's not aware. She's under the influence of the medical doctors who give her the treatments, and so she's not aware that there is a problem. And so now she's going to get treated for breast cancer, and then she says she's really excited about trying to get pregnant again, which I don't really know what that means, but apparently it means she's going to go back and do some more IVF because she doesn't understand the risks. Very interesting what goes on in the world of health. Okay, scientists demonstrate that the flu vaccine lacks effectiveness. Well, you know how it is every flu season. You can't help but see all the pharmacies advertising their flu shots and their hand cleansers and their, you know, topical germ wipes, you know, and their, you know, I mean, vaccinations are a big part of Western medicine theory. You might say they are one of its pillars, despite how shaky the theory is. I mean, it has elements of workability. But here the University of Minnesota researchers said, well, you know, best case is it's 60% effective. And, of course, not that many people get the flu in the first place. So we're talking about maybe two or three people get the flu who are, anyway, whether they're vaccinated or not, 2 or 3%. And so, when we're talking 60% effective, we're talking, you know, like maybe now 2.5 or 3.5 people don't get it. I mean, we're not talking these huge numbers of statistical benefit to society anyway. But even by their own standards now, they're saying there's just no data to support effectiveness in anybody over the age of 65. They couldn't even find a study that showed that they couldn't find a credibly done advanced scientific study in anybody over the age of 65 or anyone under the age of 18 for that matter. And, you know, and of course, the older you get, I mean, you become a candidate for these flu vaccines, but you got to remember that your T memory cells that are supposedly trained by a crying wolf with this the virus of the season, you end up building up too many T memory cells the longer you do this. So, and let's not even talk about the fact that, you know, the methylmercury is still in these as a preservative in the flu vaccines. And if you want a shot of that, I don't know. I mean, you just must not know about health, but, maybe you think it's worth your while. Hopefully not. But let's just say, you know, in these older individuals, what happens is they get all these flu shots. They start to have all these T memory cells built up. They're like memories of fights that never happened. And so, you know, it's one thing to sit around the table and tell old war stories about how you went into battle and how you won and so on. Well, now you got these guys sitting around the table telling old war stories about battles that they think they fought that they never fought. I mean, they're like, it's all BS. It's like sitting around blowing smoke. And unfortunately, the immune system learns this lesson. And so you end up with too many people who just want to tell war stories and not enough troops that still want to go into battle and actually fight. And that is the problem of the old immune system. And so whatever protection in a given season the vaccine might give a person, the effect of this over the course of a lifetime is highly questionable. That wasn't looked at in this study. I'm just kind of rambling here. This study basically says that this was done at the University of Minnesota, and it basically says that the flu vaccines are not all that they cracked up to be. And, of course, I wrote an article on this last year, very detailed article reviewing all the science on this topic called The Narrow Scope of Flu Vaccine Usefulness. So anyone, of course, who wants the documentation on why this is the narrow, why the flu vaccines aren't what they're cracked up to be. I've already reviewed that. I'm just saying they're still coming out with data confirming what I wrote last year, which is that, hey, you know, they really aren't so good. My point, of course, is get your immune system into shape. Minimally, get your vitamin D level up. Minimally. All right. This was very interesting. Soda consumption linked to violence in teens. So this started out as a Boston study, and then because Minnesota keeps an interesting database, Department of Health in Minnesota, they were asked to compare to see if they could see this trend that they were seeing in Boston. And sure enough, they did. Unbelievable. The 5 soft drinks per week, sugar soft drinks, and violent acts amongst teens statistically increases even when they factor out socioeconomic variables, smoking, drugs, I mean, all the other things that you think might be going along with, a bad lifestyle, poor eating habits, even when they factor out all the other variables, the statistical significance of the trend of the amount of soda and violence continues. Now, they didn't say why. They just said this is, in fact, a actual trend confirmed both in Minnesota and in Boston. And it's a real shockeroozy for the soda industry. Not terribly surprising. I mean, soda, what does it have? I mean, you've got a couple different mechanisms of possibility here. The colorings and the are chemicals, and they're neurotoxins, so they're neurologically irritating. And then when you consume the sugar, you get wild swings in your blood sugar levels. And, of course, when the blood sugar is going down, you're going to be more irritable, more prone to violence because you don't have a fuel, steady flow of it to your brain, so you don't think as clearly. So stress happens, and you're more likely to blow up. Plus, then you've got irritant chemicals going around in there. Fascinating stuff. I'm not in favor of banning anything. You know, I mean, we can't just go out and hunt down the Coke and the Pepsi companies. But people, if they raise their awareness of things, may make better choices one day. And wouldn't that be nice? After all, we are living in a free world. But freedom, with freedom, I think, comes responsibility. And that seems to be lacking, especially in the world of healthcare. But nevertheless, very important, and soda is something to not really hardly ever have or never have. DHA boosts brain oxygenation for improved cognitive function. So DHA, the fish oil I love to talk about, which accumulates in the brain as a priority for brain structure and function, compared, say, to EPA. And EPA was tested in this study and found not to do anything. So they had people take a gram of EPA compared to a gram of DHA, and the EPA people didn't have any better brain function whatsoever. But the DHA had a better oxygenated hemoglobin, meaning that the ability of the red blood cells to carry oxygen was improved. And when they did cognitive task testing, the imaging done of their brains had more blood flow into their head. So they had lab tests showing more oxygenated hemoglobin, and they had brain scans showing more flow to the brain upon duty calling, meaning, you know, DHA is really good for your brain. It is good for many different reasons, one of which is it helps you get more oxygen to your brain, which is going to help your brain work better. And when that happens, you're obviously going to learn better. So if you have this stuff in your body on a regular basis and you're learning things, whether you're in school or whether you're at work or whatever you're doing, you're to stay competitive, you need skills, and you need the best chance of developing higher levels of functional skills. And DHA is just amazing stuff. It is the most lacking fatty acid in the diet, and it's not in the food supply easily as it once was, because the animals don't run around and eat grass anymore. And so there's not so much of it. So anyway, my point here is DHA, very good for cognitive function. A lot of times we're talking about DHA to correct something, you know, DHA to prevent mental decline, DHA to prevent Alzheimer's, DHA to prevent heart disease, DHA to prevent obesity. And that's all fine. Those are all good, valid points. But here we're talking about DHA for the production of human ability and optimizing genetic potential, which I think is a huge, absolutely huge area of nutritional relevance and benefit for our society. Very, very big. All right. Let's go to your questions this week. First one comes from Carl. Says, thanks for your podcast, Lessons on Nutrition and the High Quality Supplements. I would like to know if there is a supplement for a condition which I experience at night. I have an enlarged prostate. When I urinate, my heartbeats are higher than normal, and once I relieve myself, my heartbeats go down. This happens every time I urinate at night. Can you help explain why this happens to me? Well, sure. Fluid buildup is part of the lymphatic system, which is a pressure system. And so when it starts to build up fluids in your body, it's not just the prostate blocking the release of urine. That is a pressure backup. and your heart, which is trying to keep things going at night, responds as a secondary system for moving your lymph. In other words, your heart isn't moving the lymph directly, it's moving it indirectly. And so when the lymph and the fluids back up at night while you're sleeping, then you get the increased heartbeats simply because once you get the increased heartbeats, your body's pushing, your heart is pushing as a compensation for the stress. So you could take some Immune Plus before bed. That would usually help. Of course, saw palmetto is good, but Immune Plus especially helps this problem move along. You might, especially with an enlarged prostate, you might want to even consider possibly some oregano oil and see if that helps during the day and in bed. Because a lot of times these, you know, it's not just a swelling related to an aromatase enzyme. Sometimes it's swelling related to low-grade chronic infections in the prostate. And so, you know, you kind of work with this a little bit. All right, Terry says, in the news recently, we heard there is a link between vitamin E and prostate cancer. We take two daily multiple vitamins, two daily protectors, and two or three daily super E vitamins per day, among other supplements as well. Is there a need for concern given the recent news about vitamin E and prostate cancer? The short answer to your question is no. But let's explore this a little bit more. This was a study published in the Journal of American Medical Association, followed up on as a study from earlier, wherein essentially what happened here, 17% increased risk with synthetic vitamin E. Now, nobody in their right mind should ever take synthetic vitamin E because it doesn't have any antioxidant functionality. It is a pathetic form of vitamin E made from chemicals and useless to human health. It's signified by the L after the D. Of course, I would never tell anyone to take that. In this study, as long as even the synthetic was combined with selenium, then there was no problem. So it's just the pure poison by itself without anything else to help it. So it's not vitamin E, it's chemical vitamin E fake that was in this study. Not to be concerned. Tocotrienol is one of the best anti-cancer compounds around. And, of course, the forms of vitamin E that we use in daily energy and daily protector are very, very high-quality natural forms of the vitamin E that would not ever show up in a study like this because they just don't do that. Plus, we do use these things in conjunction with a team of antioxidants, which is very important. So when you take the daily protector, you get your lycopene, your lutein, your alpha carotene, your beta carotene, you know. So you get the whole mixture of antioxidants, and that's, of course, very safe. Bill says, every fall I get a bad chest cold and it hangs on most of the winter. I'm tired and stressed, and I'm sure that has something to do with it. How can I prevent this from happening this year? Well, your frontline defense in the lungs, you know, you right away, daily protector. You don't want your respiratory antioxidants to run low. Vitamin A and the carotenes boost something called secretory IgA, which is a natural defense for the patrolling the surfaces of your body, whether it's in the respiratory system, in your digestive tract. And very, very important to have that as adequate. But you've hit on something here. You're talking about your energy, tired. Your immune system needs energy. You're going to be exposed to germs. And if you're tired, you're a friendly place for germs to live because once your immune system has to start doing more work, it needs energy. Immune system is very energy intense. So getting tired is, you may not get sick, but getting tired will test your system. And if you get tired and you're stressed, both immune depressors, you want nutrition to boost that. I like the Activator Plus and vitamin C in this situation. Take enough Activator Plus a day, anywhere from 2 to 4, even up to 6, so your energy is good. Vitamin C and Activator Plus, two of my oldest natural remedies for boosting immunity. And a good, you know, you can plug in some CoQ10, you can do other things for energy. But you need to get sleep during the winter, and you need to make sure your energy level is good. Most people who keep a good energy level are much more resilient, especially if they're physically fit on top of having a good energy level. Jan says, our 6-year-old boy wets the bed. I've heard food allergies could be involved. Would you agree? Any other ideas? Food allergies can always be involved with irritation in the system. You know, you can try eliminating dairy. Sometimes that does work for wetting the bed. Other times it doesn't. You can look for, you know, food allergies may be an issue. But as soon as we're talking about that, I mean, the most things for me is just getting rid of the junk food out of a kid's diet, the chemical irritants, the food coloring, the excess sugar, rather than eliminating food groups. So if, you know, that would be kind of step one. I like coral calcium powder for kids, quarter teaspoon, in an ounce of water at bed or maybe even at dinner. So he's not drinking water before bed. Quarter teaspoon usually takes care of it, maybe up to a half a teaspoon. Something about the calcium, magnesium, minerals, you get them in high enough quantity and attempts to relax the nerves, trains the subconscious nervous system to be in better shape. But that's been my best remedy for bedwetting for children. It's been the coral calcium powder. I've got more feedback of success on that than anything else people try. Cindy says, my ears ring at varying levels all the time. I've tried lymph remedies, and they help a little, but do not solve the problem. I've seen a specialist, and there is nothing structurally wrong. I'm 65, and the doctor says this is common with aging. My problem started 3 years ago after several years of high stress. The stress is better, but my ears bother me. What would you recommend? Well, I would recommend nutrients that lower substance P, as in Peter, Cindy. What has been found, and this is a lot of information coming together, but the thalamus, which is part of the subconscious brain, kind of like the hypothalamus, but the thalamus is a sensory processor, and background hearing ear noise, especially related to stress, is because substance P is being overexpressed in the thalamus gland. That's my new working theory on this, and it's causing noise. I've wrote a few articles a couple of years ago on this topic, so if you type in tinnitus, ringing in the ears on my website, you can go see what I wrote in the past about it. But it's coming together pretty clearly now. I mean, you can have problems in your ear structurally and so on, but a lot of it, in fact, the majority of the noise is from stress recordings impacting the thalamus, causing overexpression of substance P, which then distorts signaling and causes background noise. So nutrients that I like for this problem are acetyl-L-carnitine, Relaxamag or Muscle-Mag, so magnesium, especially Relaxamag, calcium AEP, quercetin, grapeseed extract, any one of those or all of them may help a lot by calming the nerves. And then lots of hobbies, lots of crafts, lots of physical activity that's refreshing to you. Those things can help retrain that thalamus gland so it's not making the noise that your ears are hearing. Ellen says, I have a horrible headache starting a day or two before my menstrual cycle. If I don't take pain meds as soon as they start, I am incapacitated for 2 days. I am 33 and maybe a little moody with my cycle, but it mostly is just horrid headaches that feel like my head is in a vice. Why does this happen and what can be done about it? It's been going on for a few years. The cause of these type of headaches, in my experience, is high estrogen relative to low progesterone. As your menstrual cycle approaches, if you're low in progesterone and thus relatively high in estrogen, then what happens is the estrogen promotes sodium retention and excretes the magnesium from your vascular system, so the capillaries on the sides of your head start to tighten up, and then it feels like your head is going to pound. It can just even be on one side or on both sides, but you're saying your head feels like it's in a vise, so normally that's both sides. This is different than a lymphatic headache that starts in the back of the neck or the top of the head. This is like the sides of the head. And those are estrogenic excessive headaches. And what I would suggest really is some progesterone the first or the second 2 weeks of your menstrual cycle. So whenever your cycle is over, that's day one. And then, ovulation would be day 14. Start at your ovulation. Go through to when your cycle starts. And use a quarter to a teaspoon a day. Rub it on your skin. And then, the 2 weeks or the 3 or 4 days before your cycle, go to a half a teaspoon. And then I'd get more magnesium, maybe more calcium. maybe more fish oil, your basics, your basic anti-inflammatories in general. So a lot of times you'll see coexisting calcium, magnesium deficiencies with these headaches, but it's really the progesterone that drives the problem. So if you know stress, wear and tear, getting, you know, doing a lot of stuff, whatever, your progesterone will be converted into adrenal steroids instead of being used by your female system. It leaves you kind of lacking in the progesterone, and that's what triggers these really bad headaches. So, for most, Ellen, the progesterone will take care of the problem, which can be a big help towards not having such a, you know, issues every month. Okay, well, that's it for your questions this week. If you have a question, of course, email it to me, askbyron@wellnessresources.com. Have a great week. I'll be back next week with another weekly Wellness Update podcast. Take care.
The Weekly Wellness Update podcast is produced by Wellness Resources Incorporated. Copyright 2008. All rights reserved. For more information on the topics and news covered in today's podcast, visit wellnessresources.com. To email Byron a specific health question, send it to askbyron@wellnessresources.com. The information presented in this podcast is for informational purposes. It is not medical advice for the treatment of any condition or illness. You should not use the information in this podcast for diagnosis or treatment of any health problem or to discontinue the use of any medication that has been prescribed to you. Consult your physician or healthcare professional for such needs. Statements made during this podcast regarding any Wellness Resources dietary supplement products have not been evaluated by the FDA. Wellness Resources dietary supplement products are not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.